Hello, and welcome to the MDS podcast, the official podcast of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society. I am Sara Camargos, neurology professor from the Federal University of Minas Gerais, Brazil. Today, I had the pleasure to welcome Dr. Zongbo Shen and Professor Harry Howden, first and senior authors from the upcoming paper from the Movement Disorders Journal, Adaptive Long-Read Sequencing Reveals GGC Repeat Expansion in ZFHX3 Associated with Spinocerebellar Ataxia Type 4. Dr. Shen is a neurologist and research fellow on the UCL, and Professor Howden is a neurology professor in the Department of Neuromuscular Disease at University College of London. Thank you both for your willingness to participate, and welcome to the MDS podcast.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time. I would like to go back to the description of SCAF4 in 1994 and the UTF family. How did you come across this family, and why do you think it took so long to describe the gene?
So thank you. That's a very important opening question, Sarah. So this was all before Zongbo and I had even qualified from medical school. But Louis Ptacek, who's an eminent neurologist in Utah, was clinically practicing doing neurogenetics, and he saw this huge Utah ataxia family, and he followed them for many years. And he's a very good neurologist, very smart. He took their blood, DNA. In those days, he did linkage analysis, something that you won't remember, Sarah, because it's before your days. But older folk like me know about linkage, and he did linkage, and he linked the gene, but they couldn't find the gene. So linked it to a relatively small region, was a sort of a couple of megabases, but couldn't localize it. And they sequenced all of the genes in that region. But due to the technology at that time, they didn't pick up the repeat expansion. So everything was sequenced, and they thought, well, what do we do here? And then what happened is Lewis moved to San Francisco, and his research then looked more at channels, headaches, sleep disorders. And so this family was not lost, just forgotten, and until technology really caught up. And that's where we came in. And that's where Lewis has been a friend for a number of years, and we chatted, and with Zongbo's help as the engine behind the study, we started to work on the family.
Wow.
And that was about a couple of years ago.
And the Iowa family.
Yes, this is from a nice lady called Kathy Matthews, who's a very good neurologist there. And this family had also got Swedish origin. And so we postulated, and we haven't proven it, but we think basically they're part of the same family. We think is if you see a Swedish ataxia patient anywhere in the world, you should think of SCAR4. I think they're all related, maybe to a Swedish sailor somewhere back in time.
Really nice. And could you tell us about SCAR4 phenotype? Is it homogeneous? Is SCAR4 distinguishable from the other SCARs?
Thank you. That's a really good question. So in the two families that we describe, there's obviously a huge pedigree. The phenotype is homogeneous within that particular pedigree. So there's an invariable presence of large fiber neuropathy at the initial presentation, and at least the ankle jerks, if not more of the reflexes, are absent, with some individuals being completely areflexic at presentation, some asymptomatically and some with symptoms of peripheral neuropathy. And the ataxia is both of a gait ataxia as well as a limb ataxia. And in those individuals, in the 13 individuals who've had neurophysiology, there was absent sural nerve action potential, and especially in the sensory nerve action potentials. So I think in our two families that we describe, it is a very homogeneous presentation with a large fiber neuropathy and ataxia.
And there are some descriptions about involvement of autonomic dysfunction. Is it a consequence of peripheral neuropathy? Did your patients have autonomic dysfunction?
So within our two pedigrees, we actually went back to look at the clinical notes, especially of the individuals whom we tested using the long-read sequencing. And there was a clear documentation of lack of autonomic neuropathy and autonomic symptoms in our family, but I understand there are other Swedish families published in the American Journal of Human Genetics paper, which do have autonomic symptoms. However, there are different pedigrees, so it'd be interesting to fully review that. And I guess to look at that in relation to the actual repeat length of the expansion in those individuals.
It slightly reminded me, just to chip in, of MSA. You've got ataxia, you've got autonomic dysfunction, and MSA doesn't usually run in families. So that was, I mean, I do an MSA clinic.
Yeah.
I don't see it in families, but I thought if I saw one of those patients in isolation, MSA would be in my differential. And it's interesting how we think they're all from the same Swedish founder, but there is a little bit of variability depending on the repeat length.
Which
is interesting.
So there is definitely anticipation as well in these families.
Well, within our pedigree, we did look at someone with a very early age of onset in their 20s and someone with an older age of onset. And we didn't see any significant difference in the repeat length. But however, in the original pedigree description from Flanagan, there was question of anticipation because some of the patients who'd actually come to clinic were deemed asymptomatic, but actually they were found to have neuropathy and some ataxia symptoms at presentation that they hadn't reported. So there might be a presentation bias. However, we didn't find out of those individuals who we tested a clear increase in the repeat length between generations. But also coming back to your initial question about whether the phenotype differs from other scars, there is a really nice paper which we cite. It's quite old, but which looked very closely at the eye movements and other clinical features of SCAR4 patients compared to the other spinocerebellar ataxia syndromes.
Yes, it's really nice. And if I come across a Swedish patient with neuropathy and ataxia, I will definitely think of SCAR4. How was your approach to find the gene?
So I think what this approach really shows is just basically it typifies how we do miss the diagnosis in some of these neurogenetic disorders. And it shows advances in technology and the challenges that we face in diagnosing neurogenetic disorders. I think just to say that obviously this has been a diagnostic conundrum for about 25 years. And that might be because firstly, this repeat is quite rare. Secondly, it may be because this repeat is very GC rich. So we've tried to attempt to do PCR sort of retrospectively after we found the repeat expansion. And despite multiple attempts with different methods, we were not able to replicate this on PCR. And I guess, lastly, it just shows, I guess, an exciting era of repeat expansion ataxias. And through this, because our approach was basically, we thought because the cause had evaded diagnosis for such a number of years, that the repeat must be a repeat expansion disorder within this region. Furthermore, within the 16q22 region itself, there are two other repeat expansion ataxias, one being SCAR31 and the other being the new SAP11 associated ataxia described in the two Chinese families. So this inspired us more to really look for a repeat expansion within this region. And I think previous studies within the German family by Hellenbroich et al. Had actually looked for CAG and non-CAG repeats within the region, including a CAG repeat in ZFHX3. Again, did not look at this GC-rich repeat. So we came across an approach called adaptive sampling using long-read sequencing. We thought this would work nicely with this pedigree in terms of trying to diagnose the patients, given the linkage was so strong within this region. And just to go through this for those not familiar with long-read sequencing, so in conventional next-generation sequencing, DNA is fragmented into quite short fragments, as we may miss structural variation, which are defined as variants more than 50 base pairs in length. Whereas long-read sequencing, we're able to sequence 10 kilobases to 100 kilobases and able to detect such variants with more accuracy, and we're able to detect some repeat expansions as well. And so we used the Oxford nanopore technologies, and this is where tiny nanopores are fixed on a membrane. The double-stranded DNA is unzipped, passes through a tiny nanopore. And because an electric current is passed across a membrane in which the nanopores are embedded, every time a nucleotide, be it CT, AG, passes through the nanopore, it disrupts the signal and electric flow in a different way. And in this way, we're able to record the DNA sequence live and in real time with some accuracy. And because long-read sequencing is quite expensive, usually for whole genome sequencing, one flow cell will only cater for one individual sample. We wanted to make this as efficient as possible. And we used an approach called adaptive sampling. And adaptive sampling is a computationally driven way in which we can isolate the region of interest. And so what we do is we feed a bed file into the thing. And that bed file of interest here is a 16q22 region. And we sequenced upstream and downstream of this with a 20 megabase region of interest. And when that region of interest is detected, the pore allows the DNA to flow through and carry on the sequencing specifically of that target region to enrich for that target region. However, when that particular region of interest is not detected, the electric current reverses across the membrane. It ejects the DNA and the sequencing starts again. And this carries on iteratively to increase the coverage over that particular region of interest, in this case, a 16q22 region. And so when we got this region, we applied a structural variant analysis pipeline using Sniffles2. And this gave us structural variants which were different from reference genome. And because we had these samples, which were individuals affected by disease and those unrelated spouse not affected by disease, we simply applied one algorithm which looked at all the repeat expansions or structural variants that were similar between those segregating individuals. And so in this way, it's a variant agnostic approach to detecting structural variation, detecting repeat expansions. And through this, we were able to quite quickly, very fortunately, identify the GGC repeat expansion within ZFHX3 within that region.
Wow, this is amazing. If I understood correctly, your approach was based on the region that was sequenced and they couldn't find anything different in this region. So you thought it was something structural, and then you did this adaptive long read sequencing. You sequenced only this part of interest of the locus. You didn't spend so much money, and you did a very good approach. Wow. And this is new, right? Your approach is pretty new, I think.
I think previously there have been studies where people have used adaptive sampling in known repeat expansions to save target enrichment and pro pull down of the repeat when you're doing sequencing. So, for example, they'd sequence Huntington's disease repeat using adaptive sampling. However, I think, to my knowledge, this is quite a novel approach in identifying repeat expansions that are novel. And we hope it can be applied to other families with linkage.
Yes.
In which there is possible repeat expansion. So it's quite a powerful tool and something that's cost effective as well.
Yes.
Given that we're not doing whole genome sequencing, then running Expansion Hunter, and we can quite accurately identify the length of repeats, the number of interruptions, and the actual repeat sequence itself using this approach.
And also, I mean, the problem is as well, if you want to screen a family for SCAR4, we're going to have to use long reads, and many people won't be able to do that.
Yeah.
So you won't be able to go to your local lab and say, can you do simple PCR or exome or even short read genome sequencing? There's not going to be many people that can do that for you. And of course, we would love to offer this and help people out where we can.
Wow. It's really, really interesting. And this methodology, so it's expensive, but less expensive when you compare it to whole genomic sequencing, right? But you have to have a very good quality of DNA, right? Tell us, how was your challenges in these families?
And also, we'll tell you about the repeat shipping and the repeat culturing.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a real challenge. And in the end, Louis just sent us all of his DNA samples in a big package. And we grew up the lymphoblasts, and eventually we got high quality DNA. And it's what you need is you need long stranded DNA. So non-column based, high quality DNA, either a new blood sample or a tissue culture from a fibroblast or a lymphoblast line. So unfortunately, several of the samples failed. And when the DNA is very poor, it tends to block up the sequencing pores. And so the girls were saying, oh, we're having to come in and unblock these pores because your DNA is poor.
Okay. It's fragmented, right?
Yeah, you have to have something quite consistent fragment lengths. But I think it shouldn't be a problem for freshly extracted DNA or from blood that we have now. I think it's because these samples are pretty old and they've been extracted using quite old conventional methods, including chloroform and other methods. So there may have been some contamination as well, which could have blocked the pores.
So we love fresh blood, fresh or frozen blood.
Any cultures.
Perfect. It's just having a nice system to extract it.
Right.
Yeah. I guess it also shows how precious samples are in studying rare disease genetics and how we need to value them. And probably using an approach like this, you just get the hit rather than go straight for the targeted region rather than sequencing the whole genome and potentially wasting DNA. That's my question.
Definitely. And do you both believe that this resultant polyglycine protein is a gain of function protein?
So it would be nice to think so and ride on the wave of polyglycine disorders that we're seeing now. So again, this is the first GGC repeat that's been characterized within an exon. Whereas we're even seeing, for example, for the NOTCH2NLC GGC repeat expansion, which is in the 5' UTR associated with neuronal intranuclear inclusion disease in East Asian populations, even that GGC repeat can be associated with an upper open reading frame and cause translation of a polyglycine protein. So it will be great if this actually is one of the first polyglycine disorders and it's the mechanism through toxic gain of function. I think the other mechanism we need to think about, because it is a GC-rich region, whether there is increased methylation and what this will actually lead to, actually a loss of function. Unfortunately, because of the challenges that we face with the DNA and the sample availability, lack of other tissues, we weren't able to explore this further in our study, but it would be a fascinating subject, including maybe skin biopsies to see whether there is inclusions which are characteristic of possible polyglycine deposition.
Yeah. Of course. And how do you interpret the interruptions in the tandem repeat of the non-expanded allele?
I think this is really fascinating because when we look at the tens of thousands of individuals who we used in our samples, we've had whole genome sequencing, an expansion hunter, which is a bioinformatic tool to estimate the repeat sizes from short read whole genome sequencing data, the majority of patients have a repeat size of 21 on the non-expanded allele. And what this shows is that possibly the repeat itself is very stable in the non-expanded allele, that everyone, most of the population, has a repeat size of 21, whatever the ethnicity. And we looked at the different genotypically predicted ethnicity sizes within our cohort. And so I think the presence of interruptions may have a role in stabilizing the repeats to prevent either meiotic instability or somatic instability. And again, further studies in this would be really, really fascinating.
And all the interruptions are consistent with serine, all of them?
Yeah, we did not look at this. So because we had the unaffected spouse, the long read sequencing data showed the presence of A interruptions rather than something that was actually a conformational.
Okay, it's really nice. So somehow, if you lose the interruption, you are prone to expansion maybe.
Maybe. And I think that would be something that we should study further. For example, we know that in SCAR2, CAA interruptions in the CAG repeat causes a different phenotype. So it would be interesting to characterize this further. I think it's difficult in this case, given the rarity of the clinical syndrome.
It's an interesting mechanism. I mean, it makes me think of SCAR8 also, which is another one where you get interruptions and non-interruptions. And that's a way of determining whether the repeat is pathogenic or not, which again plays towards needing long read sequencing to actually sequence this tract.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's fascinating. Tell us about your insights in the single tandem repeats along all the chromosomes and along 16q.
Yeah, so I guess this is a question that we're really interested in as to why so many ataxias or associated repeat expansion disorders and why so many of the repeat expansion disorders are associated with neurological disease. And I think we don't know yet. However, in a study we published last year in Brain, we used something called functional genomic annotation, which is a simple way of annotating and providing biological meaning to the genome. And we found that genes in ataxia were associated with a high short tandem repeat density along its length. And using this method, we were able to predict the FGF14 repeat expansion because FGF14 is one of those genes that causes SCAR27 through point mutations, but a repeat expansion also causes a SCAR27B. So we know that FGF14, for example, has a really high density of short tandem repeats. So using a similar approach, we looked at also the 16q22 region through functional genomic annotation and taking a map of all short tandem repeats, of which are 1.7 million naturally occurring short tandem repeats within the genome, and they're highly polymorphic. We see that 16q22 region has actually the highest density of short tandem repeats, which are naturally occurring compared to all other chromosomal regions when taking into account the length of that region. So that in itself is really interesting because it just leads us to have, you know, a hypothesis that regions which have a high proportion, high density of naturally occurring STRs have more propensity for repeat expansion. So it also leads us to, for example, in undiagnosed cohorts, look towards those regions with high short tandem repeat density as a way of prioritizing potential pathogenic repeats as well in variants of unknown significance.
Wow, it's fascinating. I'm impressed. And I think everybody's impressed too. Maybe we're going to talk together again for the next papers you're going to publish at the MDG, right?
We'll be very pleased to, and we're happy to work with anybody anywhere in the world to try and solve some of these interesting families and use Zhongbo's talent to sequence them.
Oh, yeah, of course. Thank you both for the time you have with us and congratulations for all your work on the ataxia field.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you for the opportunity.
If you enjoyed the conversation about this paper, you can further your experience with continuing medical credits, or CMEs. You can find the link to the journal CME course for this paper within the episode description on the MDS website. Journal CME is planned and implemented in accordance with the accreditation requirements of the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, ACCME. The International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society is accredited by the ACCME to provide a continuing medical education for physicians. The International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society designates this education activity for a maximum of 1 AMA PRA Category 1 credits. The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society or their affiliated journals, Movement Disorders, and Movement Disorders Clinical Practice. Any disclosures of the participants can be found within the episode description located on the MDS website.